thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 55 for the 22nd of April, 2010. Social History. And it's time for the volcanic edition of the Digital Campus podcast, coming to you live from the Center for History and New Media, where we are not under a cloud from the unpronounceable volcano in Iceland, but we are here with our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
From Found History, of course.
Yep.
And foundhistory.org and at Found History on Twitter, which we'll discuss in just a bit. Of course, also Mills Kelly from edwired.org and the fake at edwired, the fake Mills on Twitter. Hi, Mills.
Hi, how are you? I'm still wondering who that fake Mills is.
Yeah, we need to figure that out at some point.
It's unknown.
Well, maybe by the end of this podcast, we'll actually get you to adopt that account. And we have with us one of our irregulars talking to us from the great state of Vermont, the Green Mountain State, in my lovely New England, and Tom's, of course, as well. Brian Alexander. Hi, Brian.
Hi, guys. Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Brian, of course, the director of research at Knightley, which helps out liberal arts educators and institutions with adopting technology. Hi, Brian. And Brian, of course, is at Brian Alexander with a Y in Brian on Twitter. Well, let's dive right into this Twitter story. It looks like Brian and Tom and I are actually part of history now, aren't we? We are published authors in the Library of Congress because our tweets will be moving over there at some point this year as part of the library's accessioning of the entire Twitter archive going back to 2006. Of course, this is just the public tweets, although my understanding is that is a vast majority. Well over 90% of all tweets are by Twitterers who have chosen not to quote-unquote protect their tweets, which means that their tweets are private. What does this mean? This is a kind of an interesting development here, along with lots of other developments in Twitter this week. But the fact that the library has chosen to actually feel this is part of history. Brian, what did you feel when you saw this story break that the Library of Congress would be grabbing this entire archive of billions of tweets and saving it for future historians to look at?
Well, I Twittered about it first, of course.
Right.
I have a few thoughts. One was that it was a really good move overall. Library of Congress has not often been a leader in preserving web content, so it was really nice to see them move out front and start an archive for this particular project. Second thought was I was a little surprised that Brewster Kahle didn't have this. I'm wondering what the negotiations were between LOC and archive.org. Third thought was a little time to revisit the privacy, personal disclosure practices of Twitter. Is this going to make people protect their tweets and some numbers? Is this going to change the way people post? And so I'd be curious to see how that unfolds.
Tom, what was your initial reaction when you saw this being an active Twitterer?
I guess I had two reactions. My first reaction was that this makes sense for the Library of Congress. This is part of a tradition, I guess I would say, of the Library of Congress going back at least to the Second World War with Man in the Street interviews. The Library of Congress collecting social history, and so I think as part of that long tradition of collecting social history, I think this fits well with the Library of Congress's mission. So that was one thing. The second thing I thought was that it seemed as in the as if in the press and sort of the general reaction to the story was that this is the end of the story, that the Library of Congress has, you know, accessioned this Twitter archive and it's now archived. It is now preserved, so that, you know, and that's the end of story. And in fact, I really think this is the beginning of the story. You know, there's just because, you know, the Twitter gives the Library of Congress a MySQL dump doesn't mean that this is archived in any meaningful way, and that there's going to be an awful lot to do to develop both the tools and the methods, both for curators and for researchers, to make sense of this archive. There's, you know, like what. How do people isolate particular conversations from the mass of tweets? How do people isolate what kind of visualization tools will people need to try to track conversations and events as they play out on Twitter? Those kinds of issues we're just coming to grips with. I saw that the National Archives someone at the National Archives posted it. Their question is, how do we isolate the quote government tweets from this mass? So, like, the National Archives, their mission is to preserve federal records. Well,
right,
what is
right.
a federal tweet? Which Twitterers are federal tweeters? So those kinds of questions of how to curate and make sense of this archive, we're just beginning to ask with this.
Right.
With this,
there are a lot of open questions, we should say here. And I did actually talk to several people in the Library of Congress trying to get a fuller story. And, you know, at this point, there really isn't one. I mean, my understanding is that this is basically a handshake agreement. Twitter approached them about this. And they still have to work out, it sounds like, in the next few months, whether, for instance, are they going to get the social graph table in the database? In other words, who was following whom at any one point in time? That's a really big question. So would they know, for instance, that Tom and I followed each other, or that when Tom tweeted, this 1,000 people would have had the opportunity to see that tweet? That's, I think, a really big open question. And there are several questions like that. Will there be an opt-out policy, which could get very ugly very quickly, if someone could come back in? I guess that gets to Brian, your point about what happens here in terms of the user agreement at Twitter. And did people really join Twitter with the expectation that, hey, maybe this stuff will be saved in posterity, when a lot of people view Twitter as kind of ephemera? Mills, you are a resident Twitter expert.
Yes.
What did you feel about this? Were you on the side of people who thought this was a joke and that this stuff shouldn't be saved?
No, because I'm a historian. I think information about the population at large should be saved in the same way that, you know, what made me mad was when various administrations have seemed to not find their emails. I mean, that's
right.
I think I'm enough of a historian to believe that anything that we can save, especially, you know, information from Twitter, can be saved in a few very large drives, as opposed to in, you know, acres of office space. And so, you know, I think that kind of information should be saved. So that was fine with me. I think that I was thinking about what you just said about the kind of ephemeral nature of Twitter, because that's one of the things that we talked about when Twitter first kind of burst on the scene, was, well, what happens to all that stuff? You know, this was sort of one of the things that the two of you, Tom and Dan, complained about, was that, you know, unlike a blog, which stays as long as the blog owner keeps it up, this Twitter people's tweets seem to just disappear after a while, and what was going to happen with that? Well, it turns out it didn't disappear, and so it's all still there. I mean, I have still larger questions about this Twitter and how it's going to survive and that sort of thing, but maybe we can talk about that later. But from the standpoint of the Library of Congress saving it, I think it's a good thing.
Right. You know, for me, it seemed like I think for a lot of people, it seemed out of the blue and sort of surprising. And I actually saw it as unsurprising, given, first of all, I mean, the Library of Congress has for many years now been participating or producing this NDIP project, I'm going to get the name wrong, but it's at digitalpreservation.gov, the National Digital Infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. let me get another eye in there.
Yeah, and I will get it right now. National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program. fondly known by NDIP, but with the much more easily remembered URL of digitalpreservation.gov. And the NDIP program has been for many years doing, it's awarded some grants and tried to think about the ways in which the Library of Congress, which understands that in the future, most information resources will be born digital and they'll need to save that material as well. And so they're really thinking about how they can do this. And I think Twitter is really part of that trend. And they've already saved close to 200 terabytes of other materials in this way. And I also believe that they've had several alliances with archive.org. That is Brian's mentioned Brewster Kahle and the Internet Archive. And they've done quite a bit with them on archiving the web. For instance, during cycles of presidential elections, they often do big web crawls that archive.org runs and then gives the final dump of websites, which of course is another interesting thing that the Twitter archiving story brings up is, won't they also have to archive in some sense the websites that are linked to from Twitter, because so much of Twitter is actually, what do you think about this or commentary upon blog posts or websites or news stories. And if you don't have that, I was kind of wondering last week whether, you'd really have the Twitter archive if you didn't have the pages that people were looking at. So,
but Dan, isn't it also going to depend on being able to archive all the URL shorteners too?
Right. And that's another big question is what about all these? And we saw, I think, and we in fact discussed on this podcast, the death and then revival of Trim, which was a URL shortener that I used that kind of went out of business. And everyone was worried about losing that resource because then you wouldn't know what you were actually pointing to. So lots of questions. So that's one stream that I feel like, the Library of Congress has taken action and are worried about the future. And also understand that, the Twitter archive will fit probably in the future on a single drive or, the head of a pin as Moore's Law continues. But the other stream is really, I think, and Tom, you just brought this up, they do have a Folklife Center, and the library has been very interested in, as historians in general have been, in, history beyond the elites and beyond governmental records. And I see this as part of a stream in post-war history of being interested in what, the average person thinks and says and does. And, this is an affirmation of that trend in history of moving away from great man history toward a kind of broader history. And so if you can archive the blogs or the tweets of lots and lots of people, this gives historians in the future a lot of grist for the mill.
And I'm less worried about the thing that you just mentioned about the having archived the sites that people are pointing to in Twitter, because historians have been doing that kind of thing for a long time. I mean, if you read a letter from somebody from 1922 and they talk about that wonderful performance they attended last night, but they don't say performance of what, well, it's possible to figure that out by doing some research. And so now somebody in Twitter mentions this wonderful website and the Internet Archive is then the next stage in your research process. So it's just teaching a new generation that it's not all available at the click of a mouse. Instead, they may have to figure out how to triangulate these information resources the same way that we all had to do.
So one thing we should be looking for is the first set of undergraduate history projects that have to do this, where or the first assignment, where a historian assigns students to track down what is this bit.ly link referred to.
Well, and I have actually thought of, when I saw this story when it first came out, I had an idea for a future research project, not in history so much, or maybe in the history of crime, but I could imagine students in our Administration of Justice program, which we have several faculty members who are very interested in sort of GIS and crime statistics. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. So imagine students looking at pleaserobme.com and then mm-hmm. comparing that to data mm-hmm. from some other database on home burglaries.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it does bring up all these incredibly interesting questions about digital scholarship, doing digital scholarship, and then, Brian, what you were mentioning of sort of almost digital archaeology of trying to figure mm-hmm. out what a bit.ly link links to. I think all of that will be, once they have this archive, I think we'll be able to do all kinds of really interesting things that right now only people within Twitter can do, or maybe Twitter and Google and Microsoft, who've also had access to the full database, and sort of try out new forms of digital scholarship that a big corpus allows allows you to have. You know, I think another interesting vector here is that, which we've discussed a lot at the Center for History and New Media, we've had a bunch of projects that do just this, that you have to be proactive as a historian and archivist, don't you, in a digital age? I mean, if they hadn't have done this now, they probably couldn't get this archive in 10 or 15 years, and who knows what will happen to Twitter. You know, unless you're proactive, you know, I know that the Library of Congress is also saving legal blogs, because there's a lot of really good legal blogs out there, but they feel like they have to get that now, because who knows what will happen to those blogs in 5 or 10 or 15 years.
Well, I think, I think the qualification that you all have been using, that, you know, once this is up, and once this is available to students and researchers and teachers and others, is though a pretty important one. I mean, I still think we, you know, like, we're going to need to keep our eye on this, because, you know, I don't think there's, as you said, Dan, I don't think that the questions have been, the answers to all the questions have been worked out. I don't think there's any timetable for getting this archive up online and available to researchers. And, you know, I think we could not, this could sit on a shelf for an awful long time. And I guess my concern is that NDIP and the other programs at the Library of Congress and elsewhere have, you know, the resources they need to build the tools and methods to make sense of this stuff.
Right. I mean, you really have to operationalize this stuff, don't you? I mean, it's not just taking in the database. You have to write. There's going to have to be a layer on top of this of discovery tools and
right. We donated our September 11th digital archive to the Library of Congress. It was their first digital acquisition in 2003, and that, you know, and for very good reason, it, you know, is not available online through the Library of Congress website, and we've had difficulty getting funding for preservation methods. And I guess I continue to worry that people think this is sort of the end of the story, that Twitter hands LC a hard drive and then it's archived. And, you know, I'm concerned that there isn't the infrastructure, the funding, the staff, everything else to do what's necessary to make this acquisition real, as opposed to a press release. And that's no criticism of the library. It's just a criticism of the really of the funding environment for this kind of, like, essential, as we've been saying, work.
So I wonder if one way to win funding or to increase the chances of getting funding for this would be for the LOC to publicly say, yes, we're going to be doing an API for this so that campuses can write programs that will run on this. Wouldn't that be great to have?
Right. I mean, that's the question is, it strikes me that given probably some privacy concerns, I'm assuming they're going to have to erect some kinds of gates. I mean, if they just have an API, it seems like you could have commercial services built off of this archive that probably Twitter doesn't want and the LC also can't support. And it just strikes me, we have to see what the other half of the story is, isn't it? I did hear from the Library of Congress that they're going to discuss social media and the archiving of it, and I think also the service layers this summer in July, I volunteered to be on that panel, so I'm hoping to report back maybe on a future podcast. I'm not sure if it's okay to say this, but I think they're going to try to get someone from some of these big services, maybe Twitter, to be there at the meeting as well, to maybe discuss this. So maybe we'll have more details in the future about this. Just one final question on this. Mills, does this change your view of Twitter at all now that it is the social media service of record?
No.
I mean, it was interesting that some of the reactions were, actually, as a historian, they were pretty fascinating that there was this moment of historical consciousness that some people said, oh my gosh, this is, you know, now that it's being saved, should I change the way I tweet? This doesn't make you want to get on Twitter anymore, that now that it's a piece of the historical record.
No. Okay. sorry to be so unfulsome about that.
No, this is good. We need you. We need to have debate on this podcast.
I think you know that classic phrase, he's gone but not forgotten. I think Twitter's already forgotten, but not gone.
Well, I guess there's two more things that we should put in before we switch topics, Dan. One is that if not Twitter, then what about Buzz and what about Facebook? I mean, this is
right. Well, I think for me,
opposition
now.
Like,
yeah,
if you're researching social media for our time, now you've got this combination of Twitter and Library of Congress versus Google Buzz versus Facebook. I mean, it's an interesting set of options for the historian.
Right. Yeah. Well, for me, it brings up. I think it's actually one of the reasons I like Twitter is that it isn't a walled garden like Facebook is. I think we're going to rue the fact that a future president will have spent her or his, developing years on Facebook, and that we don't have the archive of what they were talking about. Or maybe if they were at keg parties, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But I think we are going to rue the fact that so much of social media life is on Facebook, and that it is a much more difficult environment to save. I frankly think it's going to be impossible, considering that the terms of service have changed so radically over mm-hmm. the years at Facebook, and that it's only mm-hmm. recently that they really prodded people through defaults to make their equivalents of tweets public, so that you could have something like this where the Library of Congress comes in and says, we want a royalty-free, non-exclusive, perpetual archiving license to this content. Same thing for Buzz. Like, where is Buzz? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And especially since it's what at least Google says is going to be a standard, like email, it's going to be distributed. I don't really see it as being something archivable. So you compare these things, and I think it's a great question, Brian. I think Twitter comes out on top as being, the service that's most easily saved for posterity.
Well, and not to mention, and I think we're going to get into two stories of obsolete services, but not to mention things like Pounce and other social media services that have come and gone and are now effectively gone mm-hmm. forever, unless there's some private archive of them mm-hmm. somewhere. We're actually, I should just mention before we move on, that we're going to be at the Center for History and New Media along with our colleagues at the University of Mary Washington, hosting a workshop on October 1st here in Fairfax on just these issues, bringing together funding agencies, archivists, librarians, historians and other scholars, industry representatives, to talk about just these kinds of issues with regard to Facebook and the LLC acquisition, but also, with Twitter and the LLC acquisition, but also Facebook, Ning, which we'll talk about, I think, in a second, Pounce, these other services that have come and gone. If anybody is interested in that, please, people can send me an email, and I can send along some additional information. We're putting together a list of people who are interested, and we'll keep you up to date.
I found it really interesting that you said send me an email and not send me a tweet. Why was that?
It's a retro.
Yes.
You're just old school? Is that what it is?
I'm archiving everything.
He doesn't want any record of these requests.
Well, here's a bridge for you then, going forward. It would be great if we could make sure that colleges and universities are represented in this archiving process as it moves forward, to see what our particular needs are. I mean, I know that for a lot of under-resourced or small colleges, that it's great news having the Library of Congress step forward to pick this up. But it'd be great to hear what we can contribute to that process.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I think we will have some reps from smaller institutions there. So that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And Brian, as you know, a lot of classes are using Twitter, and to have archives of those, I think, is really fascinating.
I wonder that then raises another point, and that is that I wonder what's going to happen when the rising generation of students gets to college, and they aren't Twitter users. Because they're not currently. The most recent Pew report said that only 8% of teens, and they define teens in this case as 12 to 17, only 8% are Twitter users, which is about the same as the percentage that have visited a virtual world. What's going to happen when they come to college and we say, okay, now you need a Twitter account? I mean, I think we're going to get the same kind of resistance that we got when, and some of us can remember, many people listening to the podcast can't remember a day before email when we told our students, you must have an email account. Why do I need
sure. an email or account? Or start blogging. I mean, it's now right. a pretty classic Web 2.0 pedagogy, where you have to go through this process of using campus blogging, hosting it locally, and if not, how do you set up an external service like Blogger or Twitter, and how do you handle the authentication, the security issues, the privacy issues. I mean, it's a, in 2010, this is kind of, it's almost old hat, but it does bring us back to the Facebook question. If the students are preferring to do their Twitter-like activity on Facebook, then we have that vast archival difference.
Right, and blogging is another thing that's falling out of fashion quickly with young people, because the same Pew report says that essentially what's happened is blogging, a blog as a way of updating the world on what's going on in my life, that's essentially over among teens. Lots of adults still do that, but teenagers anyway have ceased updating their status through blogs, and that this is it's an amazing drop in use just in the last couple of years because they update their status on Facebook,
right,
and or some other social network kind of thing, but they don't do it so much on Twitter. They do it primarily on Facebook or whatever other social network platform they use. But so I think we're going to start getting the same kind of resistance again about, what do you mean I need to have a blog? Blogs are so over. And so that's, you know, what worries me about getting too consumed with anything, any technology platform, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, is that if we think that it's correct that sort of high school students are a precursor of future technology use, the way that some people like to say that, what are the Japanese teenage girls doing? Well, that's the future of technology. Well, if that's the case, and I don't know whether it is, but if it is, then Twitter and blogging both are already on their way out as a sort of a ubiquitous platform.
Right. I mean, I guess we're going to have to pay attention to this. We'll link to this report from digitalcampus.tv, but you know, the New York Times also had an article about basically there's now a competition between Facebook, Twitter, and Google to see, you know, who can get market share on, you know, where people spend their dedicated time in social media. And they're doing this, of course, also by syndicating their materials and also their user accounts across the web.
Yeah.
So all three of those companies are trying to make, I mean, this is back to the future, right? This is single sign-on from 2000.
Right. It's Microsoft Passport.
Right. It's Microsoft Passport with OAuth.
People are actually using it.
Yeah. People are actually using it. And I think what the advantage Facebook has is they've got the young kids. I mean, they are the kids who are then need to sign on to some other service. They say, well, what's the one account I've got? It's a Facebook account. And, Facebook is just, it's really sucking the air out of this. I think the millennial market is, looking around the student center or looking at my nieces and nephews who are tweeners or teens, their entire web existence is on Facebook.
Well, and it's not just, and I have to say, it's not just the younger people. I mean, that's the other thing I found really striking in this Pew report, is that of people who have some kind of social network presence, anybody over 18, the numbers are basically the same for Facebook across age cohorts. It's around 3/4. Young adults, it's 18 to 29, it's 71%. Adults 30 and over, it's 75% on Facebook. And sell your MySpace stock now, because it's really dying. And LinkedIn is slightly higher among the sort of the 30 to 40-year-olds, but then falls down to, so it's, you know, if you look at all adults over 18, then 73% of those with some kind of social network presence are on Facebook, 48% on MySpace, and only 14% on LinkedIn. So so Facebook is kind of sucking the air out of everything.
Well, about a year and a half ago, we polled the members of the Nightly Network, about 140 campuses, and we polled them, adults, you know, what social networks are you using, what tools? And it was, we did a white paper on this. It was a lot of fun to see what people were using when and for what purposes. And about a year and a half ago, Facebook was really the leading one, and it's only risen since then. I do think, you know, it does suck all the air out. And we haven't even talked about this week's announcements. What's the developers conference called? F8?
F8, yep, Fate.
Where they've already, I know, I love that, Fate. It's the voice of fate. but they're releasing these community pages, which are competing with Google Knoll, as well as competing with Wikipedia. We don't have time to get into it, I think. And we have to cover Ning next, but
We'll get there, but we could spend a little bit more time. I mean, isn't this what? So basically, just my summary of what Facebook did this week is precisely what we've just been discussing. They're going to reach out with their tentacles to the rest of the web. They want the little Facebook like buttons all over the web, so that while you're surfing, you can say you like some website or like some service or like some product, which they can continue to build up their database of likes, which is precisely why I left Facebook. They know way too much about you. And then they're extending their Facebook sign-in program so that, let's say you ran a website, let's say your blog, actually. You can have people sign in to make comments on your blog, but then also then see, and this is the value added for these services, they can see what their friends also like. Let's say the most popular New York Times stories, if you were to sign into New York Times with your Facebook account, then you can see, Brian and Tom really like this article on X, Y, or Z. But this makes even more complicated what we've discussed repeatedly on this podcast, which is that the unintentional revealing of aspects of your private life. If you read carefully this story and then look at the new privacy settings on Facebook, TechCrunch had a great story about their new privacy section, which is called Friends, Tags, and Connections. And now the controls have become even more complicated about, you know, let's say you don't want your parents to know, let's say, certain things you wanted to do and you were a student. It is incredibly difficult to figure out in this new control panel, like, what parts of, okay, if I'm on another website, what pieces can I share? Who finds out about this? There's going to be so many unintentional reveals of private information with this new program that Facebook announced this week. And if you're on Facebook, I recommend you look at this new section called Friends, Tags, and Connections in the privacy section. It is incredibly complicated to figure that out. And so even more so, the defaults are going to mean a lot. And I just don't see how students are going to navigate these things correctly.
Yeah, I mean, the privacy thing is crazy. There was a great tweet that last night by Anil Dash, who was one of the founders of Six Apart, of the movable type blogging platform, and a kind of a, you know, one of these internet guru voices, and he said that the founders and the executives of these social media sites, these social networking sites, should have to accept the default privacy settings for their own accounts on the services. Because to really understand how the average user is going to use these services, you really need to see what the defaults are, and the defaults sometimes are not what you'd expect, and they can change the defaults at more or less any time. And most people aren't going to look behind the privacy settings. They're going to go with the default, and that's where they're going to stay. And we've talked about this a lot, but it becomes, as these platforms get are built out more and more with third party developers and others, it becomes more and more complicated and more important. You don't really see where it's going to end.
I've been thinking a lot about these kinds of issues because we've talked about them a lot on the podcast, and I've been wondering, as an educator, how much time do I have to spend teaching my students about privacy settings, and how much time do I have to spend about, you know, all these kinds of issues that we've been talking about. And I've decided that I don't actually have enough time to do that in my history classes. If I were teaching a class in how to be a successful college student, that would be a significant portion of my course. If I were teaching one of those orientation courses, that would be a big portion of what I do. And I've just decided, you know, I'm going to mention these things in class. I'm going to spend zero time going through them. I'm going to tell students, if they don't understand what I just mentioned, that I'd love to talk about it in office hours. But there's so many important things about history and technology that I have to teach them that I've actually made a decision. I'm deleting things like that from my course syllabi, because I used to spend sort of a whole class period on these issues. And I've made the choice, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I'm going to, you know, insist that our people who teach the orientation courses on campus, that they do that.
Right. I mean, maybe this has to be written into the freshman orientation. Brian, you were about to get in there.
Well, I was going to hit that from another side, which is, you know, what's the campus responsibility to this? And does it come to the individual instructor, or is this something for student life, or is this the library role, or is this actually the IT department? I mean, each of these have a, you know, pretty good claim on this kind of behavior. You know, the library, this is basic information fluency in a sense. The IT department, obviously. The other side of this is, if we have, what's the current number? 425 million users?
Somewhere north of 400 million, yep.
We were
200 million of which check in daily
right, to
Facebook.
Right, and daily doesn't just mean Foursquare, hi, I'm the mayor of Fairfax.
It
means spending a lot of time there. There's a serious information fluency aspect to this, where if students are searching for information, if they're finding news, if they're looking for stuff through Facebook, our libraries and academic computing departments, our faculty teaching students how to do that, how to find stuff. I mean, the whole social networking search world has been thrumming along pretty rapidly. I wonder where we stand on this.
Right. Well, speaking about humming along, one service that a lot of educators have also used quite significantly, including for major social networks in a lot of areas that I've seen, particularly secondary school teachers have a lot of networks here, on the Ning service, NING.com, suddenly decided this past week to start charging for its free service. Clearly had run into a common .com business model, which is that that whole idea of giving it away for free but trying to make it up on volume evidently doesn't work. And so they really, I think, pulled the rug out from a lot of people this past week by saying, you know what, you either have to migrate off our service, or starting soon we're going to have to, you know, and I think there's some huge number, something like 50% of their social networks were nonprofit related, have to really make a decision about whether they're going to continue through Ning or where do they go. I mean, can they replicate some of the social networking functionality? Brian, do you go to campuses where they're using Ning as a, for those who haven't used it, it's kind of like a white label service where you can set up your own Facebook with profiles, but they're little networks. So in other words, it could be everyone working in digital humanities could set up a Ning network, and it might be a few hundred people.
Yeah, there's been some campuses or campus offices have experimented with Ning. I've seen some where Student Life, for example, for admissions, set up Ning groups the summer before students arrive in their first year of college. I've seen individual faculty do this. And in fact, my daughter's high school, she said very casually, yeah, I have a blog assignment on my science Ning. Yeah, no big deal. It's, you know, that kind of almost DIY use is pretty widespread. I don't know how well the total numbers are. It still seems to be kind of early adopter, but it's out there. I was really struck by the crowdsourcing of a Google Doc of alternatives to this that happened. I don't know if you guys followed that.
I did. It seemed like even beyond that wiki effort to provide all sort of links to alternatives, there was even, I think, an effort to create an easier workflow from exporting into WordPress with with a BuddyPress install. Do you want to explain that? For I think we might have mentioned BuddyPress on the podcast before. But so how would you do this if you wanted to create your own social network that wasn't on Facebook, that was Ning-like, on based on the WordPress platform?
Okay, well, one issue is, it's a kind of classic issue. Wired and a few other people have pointed out that we're looking at something that started happening a decade ago. Remember Tripod and GeoCities getting your web life off of that? And it's an issue with course management tools, too, like Blackboard, of getting content, not just the content itself, but also the structure. So it seems like it's relatively easy to get the content out of Ning. The tricky part is trying to preserve some of the structure and format of it. So apparently, people working through BuddyPress to replicate that. I don't know if you can get the exact pixel for pixel, post for post structure duplicated, but at least the spirit of it, the abstract social graph, should be able to reappear that way. I mean, it's an interesting case of the commercial failing and the open source picking up on it.
Yeah, I mean, my personal feeling on this is that it's actually a failure of the service, in that, like, most of these, you know, as a practical matter, there will be migration paths and to Drupal or to WordPress and other things. But as a practical matter, I think most of these communities will probably die. They'll be abandoned. Many of them were probably barely functioning as it was, and probably this will be an opportunity for people who started these things and maybe don't have the time and energy to invest in them anymore to drop them, and then they will just kind of, as GeoCities did, just kind of die a slow death, and one day whoever inherits Ning, if they don't manage to find a business model, will decide, we're done maintaining these sites and kill them off. And so in the end, I mean, we end up with the same kind of thing we have with something like Pounce or these other social networks that have just been eliminated and now are gone from the web. We end up with just and GeoCities for that matter, these lost communities. So it's I applaud the efforts of the Ning community and the people who are trying to develop these migration paths, and I'm sure they will work, but I think the reality probably is most people won't bother.
2010 really is shaping up to be a year of concern about using off-the-rack commercial services, isn't it? I mean, we have discussed on this podcast this year the Flickr Commons issue, and I don't think we mentioned that. There was someone else, a community lead, who left Flickr Commons. I'm not sure if you saw that story. Tom, I know you've been following this a bit, but they lost another person in Flickr Commons who'd been there for quite some time. I think it was just a matter of, someone who had been at Yahoo for 5 years and decided to try something else. But it does give me a little bit of pause. I mean, I think certainly one of the leitmotifs of this podcast is, using services that are out there and, having educators and scholars and students try out new media in whatever form it is, commercial, nonprofit. But this, along with, I think, even the Twitter archiving story, is sort of something about, well, maybe we should step back a little bit and think about the longer term paths for some of these services.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, because I think, we've all had the experience of applying for funding for our digital humanities and educational technology projects. And the funders are very keen to see what they would call a business plan. Because they're, rightly concerned with sustainability. And it's just sort of interesting that, all of these services that have failed, all of these commercial services, it would be very easy for them to show you a business plan. All of them have business plans that they can produce sort of at the drop of a hat. But having
business plans that generally some venture capitalists put $10 or $20 million down on.
Right, exactly.
I mean, vetted business plans, yeah.
Right, but having these business plans doesn't guarantee sustainability. And I think, we in some ways are in the position of being, in some ways, too honest about the sustainability of our projects. That, maybe we don't come up with, this kind of cockamamie business plan. Because maybe they're, maybe those business plans aren't quite as real as they are said to be. So I think it's an interesting thing that, in some ways our funders and our the pressures are pushing us towards these kind of commercial sustainability business plans, when I don't think it's proven in any way that those things work either. So it's just it's an interesting to compare the two ways of working. And Dan, I think we talked about this earlier. Your paper, I think, did that. Your paper for
we can link to it from digitalcampus.tv. But I wrote a piece for that conference that we mentioned on last Digital Campus. Digital Campus number 54 for the University of Virginia's Shape of Things to Come conference. And one part of that paper was just about the metaphor of funding as venture capital, and that it's not a very good one in the nonprofit world. And that when we discuss sustainability, oftentimes the sustainability of something like Ning is get bought out by Google,
right?
And we
point of business model.
Right, we don't have that option.
Well, there's no exit.
Like there, that, right. The question of the exit, right, is very, very difficult. And so, You know, and I feel for the funders too, because they have limited amount of money. It's hard to do anything other than provide project funds. You know, they don't have the kind of cash that they could create long-term sustainability. You know, I talked about, you know, Series C funding, where something like Facebook gets $200 million from a Microsoft or from a hedge fund. You know, we don't have those kinds of options. So it's really difficult to see. And, you know, so I think these questions about sustainability they're always really, really difficult, because they involve enormous compromise. I mean, if you just look at Ning, the dark secret about Ning and why it even stayed around as long as it did is that the other half of the service was porn. Right? I mean, no one ever wanted to discuss this, but a lot of these social networks were quote unquote adult networks. So it was, you know, I mean, are we going to start having digital humanities projects that are half funded because the services are half porn? We could not use that as a sustainability model in a straight faced proposal to a funding agency. So
I think we can talk about other ventures with partners.
Right. obliquely mentioned, yes.
And everything becomes a euphemism, you know?
Right.
Yeah, the humanities, yeah.
Something that's interesting to look at is if people haven't visited the site Crunchbase, which is associated with the TechCrunch blog, and it covers – Crunchbase basically covers Silicon Valley startups, and it has a profile for each company, and shows the kind of funding that they've received, and the you know, the startup funding, and when they've received it, and who has provided it. You know, and it's interesting to look at, you know, the kind of smaller startups that may be kind of, you know, in their funding on a level with some of the larger digital humanities projects, you know, things that have received in the, you know, $500,000, $1.5 million, to see how those things are funded, and when that funding comes in, and how much it requires, and when they achieve profitability, and if they achieve profitability, and how they exit. You know, what's their exit strategy? That they're bought out by someone, or that they go public, or whatever it is. It's sort of interesting to look at those things, because it shows sort of this other side, that it's that all of these startups, their business plans aren't kind of as clean as what you know, sometimes we're sort of asked for. And I think that's an interesting thing to kind of compare.
Well, what's that old Far Side cartoon? The one that had, you know, the scientist before the blackboard, and there's like step one, step two, step three, and then a miracle occurs. Step four is the solution. Right.
Right.
But the flip side of this, I don't know if we have time to talk about it, is Stephen Johnson did a piece in the New York Times where he was arguing that we should be celebrating walled gardens and commercial ventures because, in his argument, they seem to be working. I mean, he was pointing to the iPhone, to the App Store, to the iPad, and he was saying, you know, we have this corporate, proprietary, closed, walled garden, silo heaven, and it works, and we like it. And I can't tell you how often I've had people on campuses ask me about the iPad in the past couple of months, and also ask me about the iBookstore, which is not the iBook. You know, it's the... it seems that for a lot of our campuses now, this is the one of the great ideological battles that's being fought, in some ways not consciously or deliberately, but nevertheless happening. Why not, instead of looking at Library of Congress, why not trust Facebook to do its archiving? Why not trust Google to archive Buzz? I have reasons for why not, but I think that argument is a deep and live one on our campuses right now.
Right. Well, I am afraid we actually don't have time to get too deeply into that, but I think this is something that we'll continue to discuss on the podcast in terms of, it was a great, we'll link to that article, but this question, right, about open platforms versus closed ones, and Facebook, I guess, is trying to become more open, just to bring it back to the discussion we've just had. But ultimately, right, for a lot of students, it is kind of a closed place. And I wonder about the Armageddon that would happen if Facebook went the way of Ning suddenly. It doesn't look like it's going to happen now or even in the near future. But in the longer term future, how do we advise students and faculty to commit to certain platforms? And do we say, you know, well, open platforms are better because it's easier to get your materials out and they're decentralized? Or do you say, well, you know what, this platform is heavily monetized and heavily controlled, and so we have more faith that it will be there in the future.
See, well, I think if Facebook were to say, okay, it's $24 a year, $2 a month, that they would see a drop in use of, what, 10%?
Right.
I mean, it's become so ubiquitous now.
Yep.
If that, and how many people have accounts now, did you say?
Over 400 million, 200 million of whom check in each day.
Yeah, so there's a business model. I can't imagine that they haven't started charging $2 a month yet.
If they had an annual fee that was payable by mobile phone, half the population would resubscribe overnight.
They would crash PayPal servers.
Well, you wouldn't use it. You'd probably use iTunes.
Right. And I think campuses, just to get to your point, Brian, are, you know, that used to have, let's say, the IT department host all the websites for campus groups. Those are all now, I mean, especially with these announcements on Facebook this week, they're all in the walled garden at Facebook. I mean, they just automatically set up 6.5 million groups, many of which are, you know, the college cheerleaders group for, you know, X campus. And all the students are on it, so there you go. Why does a university have to have some platform to do that?
Especially in this economy.
Right, right.
You know, when we're cutting all these budgets, we're not cutting the growth of them, we're reducing a lot of these budgets. I really am curious about how we can have this kind of conversation across campuses where we have wildly different levels of technology skills, familiarity, comfort, fluency. I think having a conversation here is a great start. Having it at a conference is a great start. But how do we, you know, cross the chasm of conversational adoption? How do we, you know, ask the average French professor, the average biologist, all right, choose between having your students use Forpaining versus for free Twitter versus Facebook, and here are the philosophical aspects of that. I mean, that's right. A tricky conversation to have.
Well, we are going to have to encourage our terrific, intelligent audience to converse amongst ourselves and to make comments on this episode of Digital Campus on our website at digitalcampus.tv. Well, thanks, Brian, for joining us. And thanks also to Mills and Tom for the good conversation.
Yeah, and thanks, Brian.
Yep.
Oh, thanks great for hearing us. You guys.
Yep.
And we'll talk to everyone in a couple of weeks on another issue and episode of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.